Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us at the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at eplroundtable@gmail.com.
I'm Thomas Nygren from the fansite lfcsv.se from Sweden.
Hey there, glad to be on. My name is Dylan Arvella, and I'll be talking about Australia and Manchester United.
Yeah, I'm Jake, Newcastle fan, coming back to the podcast for the first time in a few weeks. I'll be representing Newcastle, of course, and England. I write for EPL Index and The Boot Room.
All right, thanks so much for joining us, guys. Before we get into individual topics, which there will be a lot of, because we're going to talk both club and country, as you may have noticed by how the guests introduced themselves today, we will start with a Premier League topic, though, which is news that came middle of the week, but obviously this is the first time I'm recording since then. Both Sam Allardyce and Alan Pardew get jobs again in the Premier League, having done little other than just keeping their previous clubs up. What do you think of these hires, and who do you think will be more successful come the end of the season?
Well, it seems to be a bit of a case of deja vu all over again. You look at Everton, they're now 10th in the table, so the job for Sam Allardyce is basically over. It would have been really interesting to see him given a longer contract to see if he could actually do something interesting and play a bit more of a attacking style, perhaps, but that doesn't seem to be very likely. Pardew, I really don't rate him as a manager. He's a bit of a busted ass in that sort of sense. West Brom, they probably would have stayed up with Pulis, and I don't know if Pardew plays a style of football that's much better than Pulis, so it seems a bit of an odd move.
Yeah, I think it was two quite boring choices, to say the least, because we've seen Allardyce and we've seen Pardew a few years now, and they don't bring anything exciting to the game. They probably would stay up, both teams, mainly because they have good enough squads to do so, but they won't bring anything new. And for Everton, it's almost like they are lowering their expectations. They were signing players to compete higher up in the table, and now with that Allardyce, it probably end around 10th or 11th. So it would have been more interesting to see them if they had gotten Marco Silva, for example. It would be more interesting to see them. And in Sweden, we talk a lot about a coach called Graham Potter. I'm not sure if you've heard his name, but
yeah, actually, when we had our West Brom guest on, he mentioned him.
Yeah, because he's the only English coach left in the European competitions, and he's almost like a saint in Östersund, who is qualified for the next round in the Europa League. And a couple of years ago, they were in the third division here in Sweden. So hopefully, we'll see him in the Premier League in a few years, because I think English football needs to get coaches like Pardew and Allardyce and Moyes and Pulis out, and the new names in.
I definitely agree with that. Jake, a little bit altering this for you. How is it that the British media constantly thinks young British managers need to be given a chance, but then is always fine with older English managers who have failed to do very much of anything when they get hired?
I don't think there's many good young English managers out there, Kev, and that is why they're not getting given a chance, because then they don't exist. They're not out there. You see Ryan Giggs, he was meant to be wanting to go into coaching. He literally has done nothing to help his cause in that. He's not shown any interest in any job, thinks he's above his pay grade, thinks he should have a Premier League job. He's done absolutely nothing. So like all the sort of British, young British, or let's talk about the sort of British coaches coming out of the game, retiring as players. They're not interested in going down and doing their apprenticeships and learning the ropes as a manager in the lower leagues, or even on maybe the support staff and, in a Premier League club. I know Giggs did it a little bit, and I know Gerrard started it now at Liverpool, but they don't seem that interested. And I don't think there's a great desire for a lot of them to be managers. I don't think that's what English players coming out of the game really want to do. I think they want to be pundits. I just don't think there's an interest in it. Gary Neville tried. He's another great example. He got given a job just because he was friends with the owner of Valencia. He did nothing to show that he could be a manager, and it's a completely different being a pundit and a manager. You know, I just don't think they're out there. And I'm not that against either of these appointments. I think they both make a lot of sense. And I know Dylan mentioned it, the Pardew doesn't play that much, Estelle much better than Pulis, but he does. He does try and play attacking football. I know. I mean, I watched Pardew team at Newcastle for a good, I don't know, too long. He was here too long. And I don't think he's a great manager, but he's fine. He's normally fine for about 12 months. He'll make improvements there. He'll get them playing a better style. He likes to go down the wings, play quick counter-attacking football, passing out. Johan Kabay got signed twice by him. He's a very good footballer. He's not a hoofball player by any sense of the imagination. And at Newcastle, we had to, but after when we finished fifth, you know, we played some good football. We rode our luck a lot. I'm not saying he's a great tactician, but he's fine. I think he's serviceable as a Premier League coach, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And with Everton, I think they're just in a weird situation. There's nobody out there. They tried to get out of Manchester. Allardyce is obviously not their first choice. They went for Marco Silva. They probably went for a few other people as well, because it took them ages to make this appointment. And the fact that it took so long, I just think they just wanted to get something done, because Arnsworth was doing nothing. They needed to get someone in there. And Allardyce is the best of a bad lot of options. So I don't think he's going to be there this time next year. It's just a short term. I don't think
it is only an 18-month contract.
He won't even do those 18 months. And I think for him, it's such an easy job. He's probably going to get a bonus for keeping them up, even though they've got no chance of going down. He's just going to come in, have a nice time, get a lot of money and leave it. Like, he's not going to be here in 12 months. Pardew probably won't be there in 12 months, because he'll probably have a good second half of the season, start next season okay, then go off the boil. Like, I agree there should be some better options, but you see some clubs, Crystal Palace went for De Boer. That was a complete failure. Like, if you go for, it's nice to go to other options if you've done your research and you think they're the good ones for you, but these clubs didn't expect to be making managerial changes, and they've just gone for safe choices. I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
Yeah, it kind of feels like maybe they're just protecting their money, but I think the big takeaway from this segment is, to Jake's point, West Brom are going to sign Kabay in January. Up next, we're going to tilt things a little bit closer to the World Cup setting. Obviously, the World Cup draw was here on Friday. They're perfectly willing to lead in with this. There is no group of death. Way too many coverages of the World Cup I've already seen are trying to force one. There is not one, at least not to my eyes. But I do want to quickly go through and ask about each of these groups. Which ones do you think are the hardest, for starters?
As you say, there are no really group of death, but I think that Group D will be interesting to watch, because we know that Argentina is a good team. Croatia, really good team. And Iceland, we saw in the last European Championships what they can do. And I don't know a lot about how good Nigeria are nowadays, but I've heard that they're probably the best team from the African conference. So I would say that Group D might be the hardest.
I retweeted a graphic from Nick Harris, which shows the average ranking of each group, which I believe is, in some ways, it goes a long way in answering the question of which is the hardest and which is the easiest group. In Group A, with Russia, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Uruguay, there's an average ranking of 45th. And I guess you could argue that this is the easiest group, but you could also argue that this is the group that anyone could finish top. Comparatively, Group G, with Belgium, Panama, Tunisia, and England, that's a group where you're probably, the top two teams are almost guaranteed to finish in the top two positions. And you could argue the same with Group B, which is the one with Portugal and Spain in it.
Oh, the hardest one is the one that England are in, because we're not going to win any of those games. I mean, we are awful in tournaments. And the thought of Panama, they've got three times the population of Iceland. I mean, that is scary. Scary to me. But seriously, I think looking at the groups, I've not really looked at them that closely, but the one that Brazil was in caught my eye a little bit. I think Switzerland are quite a good team, a lot better than they were at the Euros. They've definitely come on a lot since then. Costa Rica did well at the last World Cup, and Serbia have always been that country that should have been doing a lot better than they've ever done. And now they've seemed to have clicked a bit. They've got some good players. A lot of them play the Premier League. Tadic and Mitrovic and Matic, you know, they've got some really good players in that squad. So I think that's going to be an interesting one. I think Brazil will probably win that group. But out of the other three, it could be really, really interesting to see who else goes through. But yeah, there's not a lot of intrigue, but I'm sure it will all get built in the media. We'll all be fed the lines of which ones which teams are sort of the hipster's choice and those sorts of ones to watch out for. But I think there's an interesting group of teams this round, and even in the group stage, like Dylan said, you've got England and Belgium and Portugal and Spain together. At least there's like a couple of big, really big matches to look forward to in those.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons we don't have a quote-unquote group of death is the amount of big-named, well-recognized countries that aren't at this tournament. Because if you throw an Italy into any of these, or a Netherlands, or a Chile, or a Ghana, or any of those, all of a sudden one of these groups would look more imposing, at least on paper. But as you say, there could be a lot of really interesting matches that we don't know about yet. Dylan said that statistically, Group A is going to be the easiest. Thomas and Jake, would you agree with that?
Well, I'm not sure. I think Uruguay has a good team, and I think Egypt will be a hard team to play, because we have seen what Salah can do. And if they have a good defense, it won't be easy to break down Egypt as well, and they will be good on the counterattack. So, and I'm not sure that Russia is very good as well. So maybe it's the weakest group, but I wouldn't say it's the easiest group. I don't think that Russia will come through to the next round.
Yeah, I don't know. There's not one standout team. I think that's what Dylan was saying. There was not one team that's going to ramp home and win all those games. So in that sense, it's going to be maybe not the easiest, but like open, most interesting maybe in terms of results. I think you can go through the rest of them and pick two teams to go through, and I'm not convinced you could do that in Group A.
Yeah, just to clarify the point on Group A, that was more that anyone in that group, if they have a bit of luck, could finish top. Uruguay probably the favourites. However, Saudi Arabia are very competitive in Asia. Egypt have been competitive, not in a World Cup sense, but in an African Cup of Nations sense for decades. And Russia, they're the host. They're actually they're the lowest ranked nation at the tournament, which is interesting. And I'm pretty sure they'll be the only side with their full squad will be domestically based. So it'll be very interesting in that sense. And also just want to add, I think Thomas mentioned a bit earlier, Group D, I think that's going to be really interesting. Croatia, they're a great team to watch. Luka Modric is a lovely player to watch for Real Madrid, but I think he steps up a level for Croatia. I want to see how Iceland fare after their success at the Euros. And I think Nigeria, they probably have their best squad in over a decade, plenty of talent in that. And I think the big fish in this group is obviously Argentina, but they're riddled with issues. And if it wasn't for Lionel Messi in that final game, they wouldn't be at this tournament. They've got plenty of problems, especially at the back. And you never know. I can actually see them being the biggest casualty in the group stage.
All right. Well, it'll definitely be interesting to see how this World Cup pans out. Obviously, we still have plenty of months ahead of us to look at it and talk about it. But definitely worth discussing now that the groups have been announced. All right, now we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll get into topics about club and country for each of our guests. Awesome. All right, now we're going to head into topics for each of our guests. Thomas, we're going to lead in with you, and with everybody, we're going to be kind of doing split duty. We'll do one question about the club, one question about the country. So with Liverpool, it's been very interesting seeing this season how all of the attacking pieces have basically had their moment to shine, with Salah, I suppose, being the overarching performer, but you have had Mane look like he's been the focal point of the attack. Obviously, in the match on Saturday, Coutinho had a masterclass. Do you think that's what's so important and vital about this Liverpool attack, is that it can kind of come from anywhere at any moment?
Yeah, I think that is a very important part of the squad right now, because the past years we have been relying on one or two players to score. It was when we had Gerrard and Torres, they needed to be good. And when we had Suarez, he needed to be good. Now we can rest a player like Salah and still beat Stoke. And we can rest Mane and still beat Brighton. So the width of our attack is very important. And I think that the most important player right now is Roberto Firmino, because he's got abilities that the other attackers doesn't have. So it's always when he's playing at his best that the others score. And he didn't start against Chelsea. And that's the only time the past month that we only scored one goal. So it's really interesting to see the way that Klopp has started to get these attackers tick. Because I don't really like the way that he played Coutinho at the start of the season in the midfield. Now he's further up in the pitch and closer to the goal. And we saw yesterday what that means for Liverpool. So now we have about four or five players who are just dangerous. And that's good coming forward, because in December we have a lot of games coming up and we can't play them every time. So now we can rest Mania when he's a bit injured, and we can rest Coutinho when he's tired, and we don't have to start Salah every game. So hopefully they will be fit coming in February and March when everything is starting to getting closer to the end.
That's a really interesting point on kind of the depth preventing injury instead of the depth being needed after an injury. I think Manchester City have that as well this season, where at times they dip if De Bruyne got hurt or if Aguero got hurt, but now you just have Jesus and Silva and Bernardo, if you need him, all willing to step in. Also, you touched on Firmino there. He's already played four positions for you this season. Curious as to where you think he can be the most effective, which, as you mentioned, he is very important to your play style because he does bring something else to the table.
Yeah, I think he's the best when he starts in the middle of the three at the top, because I almost would say that he's our best defensive player as well, because he's the first guy into the press. And yesterday he won a lot of balls at the top of the game. So we didn't need to have Wijnaldum and Emre Can do so much defense as I was afraid of beforehand. So I want him to play in the middle atop. Not out on the left side as we started him, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, because he's at his best when he plays in the middle and he has Mané, Salah, or Coutinho beside him.
Yeah, he can definitely be effective for you there. And for fantasy owners, he is listed as a forward, so that's also where you kind of want him to be. getting away from that and into a bit of World Cup news. Obviously, Sweden have qualified for the World Cup, which is something that you and I discussed at the end of the last Euros. And you were saying you weren't particularly optimistic, especially with Zlatan leaving. Lo and behold, you do end up qualifying. Just curious as to what changed so much in between then and now, both in your perception and kind of in the reality of how Sweden play as a team.
Yeah, we changed the coach after the last qualifications. And it's been a very good change, because if you look at our squad right now, there aren't very good players in the team. Our attackers that started against Italy is Marcus Berg, who plays for Al Ain in Saudi Arabia, and we have Ola Toivonen, who's a substitute in Toulouse, and the substitute who came on against Italy was Isak Kiese-Thelin, who plays for Waasland Beveren in Belgium. Our central midfielders plays for Hull City and Seattle Sounders. So there aren't very good players, but when they come together as a team, something happens. And I think Sweden is a very tough side to play, because they are good in good defense and work hard together. And we proved that when we beat France in the qualifications, we beat Italy in the qualifications, and we were ahead of the Netherlands in the group. So something has happened in Sweden. I think a lot of players know what to do on the pitch, and they work hard together. And Janne Andersson, who is the coach of the team, is of course a very important part of that. So it will be interesting to see in the World Cup if we can build on that, because we won't be favorites in maybe in the first game against South Korea, but apart from that, it's we can defend and try to counterattack and score some goals. So it was fun to watch Sweden again. It's been quite boring to watch them the past couple of years, because everything has been built around Zlatan, and it should be, because he was a very good player for us, but the other 10 were just like standing by and watching. Now there are 11 hard-working players on the pitch, and that's more fun to watch.
How do you rate your chances of getting out? Obviously Germany are the big dogs in your group, but it feels like Mexico and Korea could be gotten at it if you caught them on the right day.
Yeah, I think we have a decent shot. It's it could have been an easier group, but it could definitely be a harder group as well. So, of course, Germany will win the group, and I think we won't stand much of a chance against them. But again, I think it will be the game against Mexico that is most important, because South Korea, I think we can have a very good shot to beat. And I haven't seen Mexico very much since the last World Cup, so I don't know how good they are. But I've seen Javier Hernandez in West Ham, and I think that Dos Santos still plays. So they have a few good players. But if we have a good day, then I think we can beat them. And to be in the next round will be a success for this team, who is really 2 years ahead of it, because it was the next European Championship that was the goal when Janne Andersson signed. And this championship is almost like a bonus for this team.
All right, now coming to you, Dylan, we're going to start off with Manchester United. And I want to start, there are some negatives you could take at the moment with United, but I want to go with a positive, which is Jesse Lingard, who has gotten two consecutive starts, three goals and one assist in them. Do you think that now that he's been given a chance for minutes, he could continue to get them? Like, has he earned his place in the starting 11? Or do you think that come January or come next summer, there'll just be another high-profile player in to replace him?
Look, I really like Jesse Lingard, and he's a fan favourite at the club because he's come through the academy and he's scored some pretty big goals, including an FA Cup winner. He definitely has some deficiencies, but I think he makes up for that with his pace, his energy. And I think what Jose Mourinho really likes is his tactical discipline to fulfil a role. And I think that's why he's come in for Henrik Mkhitaryan, because I think that he's able to fit a style of play that Mourinho is trying to implement in the side. And I think if he's able to do that, as you've seen with Fellaini, Mourinho will really value that. So I think that even though he's not one of United's, he isn't technically in United's best 11, he's definitely got a place in this squad.
Yeah. Do you think his best chance in would be on that right side, though, especially while Mkhitaryan kind of struggles over there?
Well, he's very capable of playing out wide. If you are to put him on a wing, he's probably better out on the right. But I'm pretty sure his favourite position is in behind the striker, which I think he's proven to do a really good job in there as well. But in terms of getting minutes, out on the right side is most likely the most likely avenue for him to get minutes for United.
Interesting. On to the international stage, Australia obviously have also qualified for the World Cup, but changed manager after doing so. Very curious to hear what kind of the background was on why your manager got the sack.
Well, he didn't get the sack. He actually resigned. So I'll go back a bit. The rumour that Ange Postecoglou, the former Australian manager, he would leave the post came after the Syria playoff. So we had two playoffs, first against Syria in Asia, and then Honduras from CONCACAF. The report said that he would leave regardless of whether the Socceroos qualified, and the FFA and Ange Postecoglou refused to sort of acknowledge this report to say whether it was right, or even to say that it was wrong. So there was plenty of debate in the media over whether or not this would happen. And for the record, I was firmly in the camp hoping that he would stay, but really, if I'm honest, there was probably 30 or 40%, maybe even 50-50, the Australian footballing public was split on whether they wanted him to go or not. We ended up beating Honduras thanks to a second-leg Mile Jedinak hat-trick, deflected free kick and two penalties. So Australia's passage to the World Cup was confirmed. And a week later, Ange held a press conference and announced that he would be stepping down. He didn't cite a specific reason, which led to a whole spate of rumours. The speculation he quit due to media pressure, which I don't really buy into, because he's been in football for a long time and he knows what the media is like. There was another rumour that he had a club gig lined up, which also I'm not too sure about, because he hasn't really seriously been linked anywhere yet. If he was to go into club management, it's most likely that it would be in Europe. As for who replaces him, well, at the moment, there is another major issue in Australian football, and that surrounds the FFA, which is set to be taken over by a FIFA normalisation committee due to a long-held political disagreements among the voting members of the FFA. It's pretty embarrassing, really, for the powers that be. Even worse, our bid for the 2023 Women's World Cup is in jeopardy. And there's even talk that our place in next year's World Cup could come into question due to potential government interference. So that's concerning. It's very unlikely at this stage, but the fact that FIFA is coming in to take over the FFA is on the cards. So there's a very real possibility that Australia won't know who the coach for the World Cup is until February or even later, which is far from ideal. And as for who is going to be the coach, the debate now surrounding the Socceroos coaching position, and it's always been this, has been whether to be a local coach or a foreign coach. This is pretty much a debate had in pretty much every nation around the world. My belief is it should be a local, unless it's someone with real pedigree, say Gus Hiddink, who was in charge in 2006 when we qualified for the knockout stages. I wouldn't be against this move. He's currently out. He's. I'm pretty sure he's retired, but I'm sure, he might be coerced into coming back and helping us out again. There's other foreign candidates, include Carlo Ancelotti, which I can't see that happening. Surely, I think he's the Italy job might be more enticing for him. So that's dreamland, really. Bielsa's been linked, which his track record as an actual coach rather than sort of, a theorist is debatable. And Jurgen Klinsmann, and you were saying earlier off the record that that's been a name that's come up in the American media. Yeah. I have seen a few links, but I don't think that is very likely because I'm pretty sure, as I mentioned earlier, if we go with a foreign option, it's going to be someone with pedigree. And I think the FFA, who, as I mentioned earlier, might not be the ones making this decision, will be looking for someone with a bit more pedigree. Like Klinsmann's a well-known name, but unfortunately for him, is whether it's a well-respected name in football, at least as a coach, is questionable. The favourite to get the job is a man by the name of Graham Arnold. He coaches Sydney FC, who currently hold all three pieces of silverware in Australian football. He was in charge for a short spell about a decade ago, but his style is really pragmatic, which is basically the total opposite of Postecoglou. So while his track record is solid, it would be a really serious change with potentially only one or two friendlies before the tournament kicks off. Other local nominations include Tony Popovich and Kevin Muscat, two players that have spent time playing in English football. Popper, he's currently struggling in Turkey, while Muscat's currently struggling with Melbourne Victory, who are arguably the biggest club in Australia. So other than Graham Arnold, there isn't many local coaches that garner too much hope. And to be honest, the best candidate for the job is still Ange Postecoglou.
Yeah, it will definitely be interesting to see how that works out. As you say, could be a long time before we actually know who will be managing Australia at next year's World Cup. Jake, talking about Newcastle now, after starting every match up until last week, all of a sudden Rob Elliott out as the starting goalkeeper. What do you think led to that decision from Rafa Benitez?
I just don't think he's very good. He's something he's done quite a few times since he took over as manager. Benitez, he changed our manager very quickly last season with Matt Sales and sort of bought in for quite a big fee and then sort of got shit. Didn't look great and was given a chance for over sort of a 10-11 game stretch, then got changed. And it's obviously the same as happened with Rob Elliott. He's been given a chance. He didn't want to chop and change him too early. He's given him the first sort of 10-11 games, saying, "You're my number one, prove you should be it." And he hasn't done that. He's never really looked confident. He's never really made a save that you think, "Oh, that save's kept us in it." He's just been very sort of just average. And Cole Darlow, as much as he's a bit of a he makes mistakes, and there's a few very famous sort of Twitter vines that was sort of did the rounds more in the championship of him making some ridiculous mistakes. But on the whole, he does really good saves, and over the course of last season, he probably saved the small points that he let up. So I think he's one that's probably got the most potential out of all the keepers we own. So I'm quite happy for him to be given the chance. I think even Eden Hazard, I've not seen the article, but I saw something floating around on social media with Eden Hazard praising Cole Darlow for something. I haven't read it, but I mean, I might have completely made that up, but I think I saw something about it. So that an interesting thing to maybe look into. I probably should have done that before I came in here, but yeah, I think he's a good keeper. I think he's fine. He's been on the England radar for a little bit as well, at least last season, on the very fringes of the England radar, but he was on there and mentioned by some. So yeah, I think he's good enough, and I'm happy to be given a shot in the first team. We needed something to change, and I mean, we haven't really had any results to write home about recently, so we'll give this one a go.
So it's just kind of like a we'll see what happens kind of solution. I did see a Tottenham supporter saying, why don't we loan you or somebody else Paulo Gazzaniga? Would that interest you at all, or would that just be like another mediocre goalkeeper with long-term potential?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm really that interested in that. I'd be interested in Michel Vorm. I don't think I'd be interested in Paulo Gazzaniga, who, when I saw him at Southampton, was pretty average, and one good game for Tottenham doesn't make a career. So, yeah, I mean, I think we want to sign a new keeper as one of the priorities over the summer, and it didn't get done, probably because the takeover stuff for Mike Ashley is very cost efficient and doesn't want to spend for needless reasons. But I think we'll probably have a new keeper sooner rather than later.
Interesting stuff. Also, Dwight Gayle did get the goal when you got promoted. You mentioned that you would definitely need to improve your forward ranks. We thought that it happened with Joselu. Now a little bit question mark about that. Do you think it's time Gayle gets given that chance kind of longer term?
No. I don't really. No, I don't. I think Mitrovic should be given a go. And I think he's the only one in our squad who Joselu is very good at holding the ball and links up the game well, and he does a lot of stuff off the ball, pressing and that sort of stuff well, but he has absolutely no goal threat. And the two goals he scored, one was a tap-in and one bounced off his shin. Neither of them really count in my eyes as being a good striker's goal. So he has absolutely no goal threat. And then with Dwight Gayle, he's a good finisher, but he doesn't really do a lot else. And I think every game he started the season, we've lost. So, yeah, I'm not that interested in seeing him be given a long-term shot. I think he's better off the bench. I think Mitrovic has got I don't know the word to use, but he's quite something special. There's reasons why he doesn't play. He's a bit of an idiot. He's all of this, but he's still only 23. He's got so much potential. He can hold up the ball, and when he's motivated, he looks really, he's our best striker by far, and he's got a goal threat. I just think he needs to be given a chance. Against West Brom, when he came off the bench, he may not have scored, but he changed the game. Things he did, open space up for others. He contributed in the build-up as well, and I just think he just deserves to be given a shot. There's a lot of reports saying he's unhappy and that he's looking to move back, and his two former clubs have both been linked as possible loan moves, but I just think I'm quite happy for him to leave if Rafa doesn't want him. But for this next month, we need something to change before the transfer window. And we should just give him this month, say, you're our starter striker for this month. Prove why you should be starting for us. If he doesn't do it, fine, let him go. But I think he deserves a shot. And I think, honestly, he's probably our best option there.
Well, if there are question marks up front and there are question marks in goal, are those going to be addressed? Or do you think you're just kind of riding out and hoping to be at least 17th?
Right now that's probably it. I'm not too down, considering we've only won once in September. I think there's a lot of factors that have gone into that. If our defense was very good until Jamal Lascelles went off injured, he went off when it was 0-0 against Bournemouth. Since then, I think we've conceded 13 goals and we've scored like four. So, and before that, we'd conceded 10 in like the previous 10 matches. It's a massive difference how big of an effect it has been losing our captain. And I think the quicker he comes back, the better for us. And I think when he does come back, we'll be a better team. We've got some good players. We'll be fine. I think I'm not too worried. The fact that when we started this run, we were, I think it was 7 points off the relegation zone. And now after losing all these games and not picking up any points, we're only 5 points off the relegation zone. like the teams below us are not really making up that ground. I don't think we're one of the. I think there's going to be three worse teams than us. I just think we'll be fine. I think it's just we are suffering for a lack of investment. We're suffering for, mainly a lack of investment. But that's not the only excuse. Rafa Benitez is not completely absolved of any blame because we didn't get money invested in him. I think he should maybe have done better with some of these matches, but. We're a newly promoted club. We're doing fine. We went on a bit of a bad run, but most teams will go through that. We've got two massive home games now against Leicester and Everton, and I think I would be surprised if we didn't win at least one of those. I would be surprised. I think it can't keep going on forever. Benitez is too good a coach to keep losing matches. He's working with a very limited squad, and I think that's a lot of the reason for maybe the negativity at times. But he's. I can't see it keep going on for long. And the takeover stuff is still going on. And nobody really knows what's going on with that. But I think regardless of takeover, we need to get to January. And I think Mike Ashley is too smart of a business person to let us go down again, especially if he wants to sell the club. He will have to invest a little bit of money, even if it's what sort of the next payment of Premier League TV money, which I think is due around at the end of December. If we just spend that on the team, bring in a couple of decent players, I think we'll be fine.
Yeah, you sort of just mentioned the takeover. Do you have any other thoughts on that, and do you think that could potentially influence how Newcastle and Rafa Benitez approach the transfer window?
Definitely. I definitely think it has. I think there's. I know for a fact that there's players that are being looked at for a take. If we got taken over, there's players that are on our radar, and if we don't get taken over, there's players we're looking at as well. I think there's a difference in price. As you'd expect, I don't think that the people, at least the favourites, the company that are looking to take over Newcastle, the ones that have been heavily rumoured in the press, Amanda Staveley, I think they made a bid. They've got links to Arab money, but I'm not sure if they would use it. I don't know how much it is. I think they're involved in the Man City takeover, but I think. Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen before January. So I think we're just going to have to get a couple of average to decent players in and just hope go from there. I think the takeover stuff is going to carry on to the end of the season. I think I'm right now. I'm pretty confident it will get done. The noises sound a lot different to when he was trying to sell before and didn't really have an interest. I think he does have a genuine interest to sell it, and it's just it takes time. And I think it's. Yeah, and the stuff with the tax, I think there's some tax problem we have, or at least the HMRC raids and stuff like that are probably not helping the takeover go any quicker, and the differentials in price. But yeah, I think it will happen, and I don't think it will happen before January. I think we're just going to have to hope that Mike Ashley isn't an idiot and protects his own investment, because he'd have to be an idiot not to invest in this squad in January.
Right now, we're going to head into Player Watch, where we're going to talk about the player that is most crucial to you reaching your goals, both in the Premier League and your country at the World Cup. Thomas, we'll lead in with you, starting with Liverpool. What do you think your targets are for this season for your club, and who do you think is the most important player in getting you there, knowing that earlier we talked about how the benefit of Liverpool squad this season is there isn't just one guy to rely on?
Yeah. Well, the squad goals should definitely be to be one of the top four teams. I don't think that we have to be the top two, or there are no way that we can compete with Manchester City to win the league. So if we finish the league at fourth place, I would be very satisfied. And if we look at the Champions League, we should definitely be to the next round. And once we're through, then it depends a lot on which teams we face, because if we get Barcelona or Real Madrid, it of course will be very hard to go to the next round. But if we not get that good team, then maybe we have a shot to get the quarterfinals. And once we're there, everything can happen. So at least top four place in the Premier League is the main objective, the way I see it. And the most important player we touched on earlier, but I think it's Roberto Firmino, because he brings something to the team that Salah and Mane doesn't do. So I would say that he is the most important player. Before the season, I thought it would be Joel Matip, but I haven't been very impressed with him now. And he's out injured, and our defense is a problem. And he hasn't been as good as I hoped. So maybe our most important player will come in this January, hopefully.
Yeah, and for Sweden?
For Sweden, it's, as I said earlier, it's Sweden is a team now more than built around players. But the most important player is our captain, Andreas Granqvist, central defender. A lot of people talk about Victor Nilsson Lindelöf, and they should. He's in Manchester United, and he's young and talented. But Andreas Granqvist is the main man in Sweden. He plays in Krasnodar in Russia, not the most fancy team, but he's very popular there. And in Sweden, he's almost like a god now after the games against Italy, where he was practically everywhere on the field. So we need him to be at his best in the World Cup. And if we want to score goals, we need Emil Forsberg, of course. He's the main man going forward. The attackers aren't that good that they can score on their own. They need Emil Forsberg to deliver the balls before the goal. So I would say Andreas Granqvist and Emil Forsberg really need to be at their best if we want to go to the next round in the World Cup.
Well, it's still got to be to win the title. We're 8 points off after a few late Manchester City wins. They have been spectacular. There is no getting around that. But Manchester United still have the potential to make a real title challenge. A win against Manchester City next weekend will be a huge step in that process. The big concern is that we'll be without Paul Pogba for that match, and I believe two matches after that. And obviously, while he was injured, Manchester United's form seriously dipped. He's the most expensive player in the league, so it's understandable that the side relies heavily on him. But I think it's been used as an excuse for a lot of the players to, Pogba isn't playing, so you know it's okay for Lukaku to not be at his very best, or Mkhitaryan or whoever, which I think is a bit of a cop-out when all these players are expensive players in their own right. With that, and despite Jose seemingly saying otherwise, Dave De Gea, after his performance against Arsenal, is probably our most important player heading into this match. 14 saves against the Gunners, and I'm pretty sure that's a Premier League record. For mine, he's undoubtedly the best keeper in the league, and he's top three in the world in my opinion, and he might break that 13 saves record against City next week.
All right, and for Australia, are you looking at this Group C and thinking you have a good shot of advancing?
Well, we're definitely the outsiders in the group, considering our three opponents are ranked 9th, 11th, and 12th, while we're 35th, or maybe higher, between 35th and 40th. Probably should know that off the top of my head, but you know, anyway. But considering we had Chile, the Netherlands, and Spain in the last World Cup, we'll definitely take this group. France is obviously the big fish in this group. However, they've been known to slip up, e.g. Lloris against Sweden, the side against Luxembourg. So while there's plenty of talent, I can see Australia, if they're really on their game, getting something out of that first match, which is in Kazan, which is actually the city that Australia will be based in, which is I believe a positive considering the amount of distance a lot of sides will have to travel in this tournament. Denmark, obviously, Christian Eriksen is the star player in that side, but they have a few other quality players. I'm being pretty impressed with Thomas Delaney in the Bundesliga, but the squad itself in their playoff, they came second in a fairly average group in my opinion in European qualifying, and I didn't watch the 5-1 defeat of the Republic of Ireland in the second leg, but I watched most of the first leg, which finished 0-0. And you know, it's Republic of Ireland are not a good side, so I was pretty disappointed considering Denmark were the home side in that leg. So while they're 11th or 12th in the world, Peru is 11th, or you get what I'm trying to say. One of them are 11th and one of them are 12th. Denmark are beatable, and that's probably going to be the key match in this group to determine who finishes second. Peru, fifth in the South American qualifying. They finished ahead of Chile, who are obviously the two-time back-to-back Copa America winners. So they have pedigree in some sense. Andre Carrillo is a very, very good player up front for him. So is Jefferson Farfan. But they struggled past New Zealand in the intercontinental playoff, nil all in Wellington, I believe that match was played, and then in Lima, finished 2-0 to Peru. And like I said, New Zealand are not a good side. I believe Australia a step up from that. So I think we can really get – that's a must-win for Australia, and I believe that's the last match. So, Look, I can see – I can realistically see us getting 4 points out of this group, and it may come down to the result against France, whether we can get a better result against France than Denmark.
And if there was a player that you'd highlight in particular for Australia, I mean, from an outside perspective, it seems like it would have to be Moy.
Well, the thing is, Aaron Moy, he's currently the Australian playing at the highest level. However, unfortunately, in World Cup qualifying, he hasn't performed as well as he has for Huddersfield, which there's no doubting his talent. For someone so slow, the ability he has to control the game is incredible, and you've got to be technically fantastic, to cut it if you're as slow as Aaron Moy. And the pasty Pirlo, as he's known down here, he's definitely an important player, and we hope he steps up. But the player that I'd like to sort of signal and is crucial to this, crucial to Australia qualifying for the knockout phase, is Tommy Urich. He's our striker. He's replacing Tim Cahill, who will be 38 by the time that World Cup comes around. He'll probably be in the squad, Tim Cahill, but he shouldn't be starting. He isn't our best player, but he is going to be our main striker. He's a big lump of a lad. He plays for Luzern in Switzerland, but he lacks that cutting edge. And if Australia are to get out of the group, we need our main striker to be putting the ball in the back of the net. So I feel he's going to be the real key for us getting through to the next round.
All right, and Jake, who has been best for Newcastle this season, and do you think they're good enough to kind of carry you to safety this year?
Well, a few weeks ago, I'd have said Mikel Merino. I thought he's been really good this season and everything that he did, and I thought he was sort of the centrepiece to our team. But recent results have sort of shown me that it's not him, and it's more Jamal Lascelles that is massive to us. Our defence is an absolute shambles without him. They just don't look the same. They don't look like the same group of players. And it's really weird that one player and sort of the captain can have that much of an influence. I thought the captains haven't that much influence on the team. It's sort of passed now, and it's sort of the managers to have that power. But he seems so, so important to us. And if you had told me this at the start of the season, I would have laughed at you. A lot of people thought he was our fourth choice. He was our fourth best centre-back. And I wouldn't have gone that far, but I thought there's a lot of question marks about his ability to step up and play in the Premier League, but he's been excellent, and I think he's easily our most important player, and the sooner he comes back the better. I think when he comes back we'll concede a lot fewer, and when you're conceding fewer, the attack have more freedom and sort of license and belief that we can get results, whereas at the moment we need them to score three and four goals every game, which just isn't going to happen. We don't have those players, and so I think the return of Lascelles is important, both in a defensive and a leadership aspect. Definitely he's our most important player.
All right, and Jake, for England, who do you think is going to be most important? I assume that while you were being jokingly pessimistic earlier, that by the time the tournament rolls around, England will be looking at this group and thinking, maybe we could win the whole dang thing.
I go into every tournament thinking we're going to win the whole damn thing. when it's about a month before the tournament, once the Premier League is out of the way, I'll be thinking England are going to win the World Cup, and no one's going to be able to dissuade me from that point of view. The group is really nice as well, and I think we should have, fingers crossed, we should have no problems getting through that group. But this is England, so you never know. But in terms of personnel, it's difficult. I think we've not really had a settled team. I know we sort of switched into this 3-4-2-1, and it's has been encouraging signs. I think in the last two friendlies, I think they were encouraging signs. We were against Brazil and Germany, you know, two of the best teams in the world. And we could have won either game. I know we could have easily lost them, but we held our own, and we looked... It wasn't embarrassing, especially the amount of players we had missing, which you have to take into account. You know, Kane wasn't playing, Sterling wasn't playing. We had a number of other players out. So if you bring those guys back in, I think we've got a really good chance. I think the English players in the Premier League are really benefiting from the coaching that they're getting, and hopefully that will translate onto the international stage. I think if this isn't Noman, I don't know what is. I think Guardiola was working in Spain when they won the World Cup, and then he was working in Germany, they won the World Cup, and that was the next World Cup, and he's working in England. So yeah, I think I can see it happening. All the work players he's working with, John Stones, Raheem Sterling, you know, they're all doing really well. But the one player I think is important to England, and he always comes off looking really good, a lot better than he does for his club team, which is really odd, but Adam Lallana, I think he's really important for England. He always, the runs he makes, the work rate, his link up play of the attacks, and because he's not like the biggest name, the focus isn't on him, and I think a lot of what he does goes unnoticed, but he's so important to us, and the sooner he gets back playing for Liverpool regularly and getting minutes under his belt ahead of some of the better, I think he's one of the first names on the team sheet. He's not that exciting, but he's in an international scene, in an international sort of arena against those sort of clubs, against those teams where we're not expected to we're not going to go into many games as favourites against the bigger teams. We have to be playing those players that can work hard and do a job off the ball and are disciplined. We can't always be, you know, just picking those that play for the top teams, because I think that's a mistake we've made in the past. We've been picking players based on, you know, what clubs they play for. But like, if we're going against Germany or Brazil, I want a centre back that defends a lot, right, as opposed to one that plays for Tottenham maybe and doesn't get a lot, who doesn't have to do a lot of work defensively or as much as the smaller clubs. Like, put Michael Keane in there or Harry Maguire, who are doing a lot more defensive work. I'd much rather have those players in because they're used to doing the job that they'll have to do in that game. If that makes
interesting.
Sense.
Interesting. Yeah.
So I think Adam Lallana fits into that perfectly. I think you can blend him in with Sterling and Kane in the attack and Ali as well. But I think he does so much work off the ball that he's so important, and I think he's probably England's most important player.
All right, well, that'll just about do it for us today. So if you guys have any projects you'd like to plug or want to tell people where they could reach you, now would be a good time.
Yeah, I've been Thomas Nygren from lfc.se, lfcsv.se. You can find our webpage at that address, and you can find me on Twitter at Thomas Nygren. As I've said recently, previously when I've been on this show, that it's in Swedish, but you all know Google Translate, and there are a lot of good pictures on the site as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure. You can find me on Twitter at Dylan Arvella.
Yeah, you can get me on Twitter at Jake Jappel with two N's. I work for EPL Index and the Boot Room, and I'm hopefully sorting out some more interviews for the Boot Room. I did one with Bobby Reid a few weeks ago, and we're hopefully to get a few more of those sort of pieces up in the next few weeks, so keep an eye out for those.
Yeah, and I'm your host, Kevin DeVries. You can find me on Twitter at Kevroff, and you can find most of my fantasy writings over at goal.com under the gaming tab. Thank you guys so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure as always, and we hope you keep listening.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.